Les Claypool is our guest today with a new album called Of Whales and Woe with a nautical theme. Les is best known as the founder and bass player extraordinaire with Primus. And since Primus went on hiatus, he has been busy with many other musical projects, including reuniting Oysterhead with Stuart Copeland and Trey Anastasio to play a set at Bonnaroo this summer, as well as making a movie and writing a novel. We are happy that he found time to play live for us. Let's start out with the band with this song called Rumble of the Diesel.
In the past.
Les Claypool is with us today, and we couldn't be happier. That is Rumble of the Diesel. That is part of Wales and Woe, and as we mentioned, this nautical theme goes through much of this. You know, it's interesting. Nautical themes, this is quite a stretch. I guess Oysterhead has more to do with New Orleans and oysters than it does about having a nautical theme to it. But that's also been part of your summertime. You got a chance to get back together in that trio situation with Stuart Copeland and Trey Anastasio.
Yes.
I don't know. I have trouble coming to work each day. Do you get distracted with all the different things that you're involved with?
I don't. I love sushi, but I don't want to eat sushi every day. You know, I like having a little this, a little that. You know, and that's what this is all about. And I think it helps the synapse keep firing. You know, I'm trying to stave off Alzheimer's. You know, people say I don't like doing crossword puzzles. You know, this is my way of keeping things firing upstairs, I suppose, because I got to remember all these tunes and lyrics and blah, 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 blah. But the Oysterhead thing, especially Bonnaroo this year, was unbelievable. I think it was the best show that we've ever done by far. And one reason is that Stuart was killing. I've never seen him or heard him play like he was. His brother Ian passed a little over a month ago, and it was right in the midst of all the rehearsals and whatnot, and you could tell it was, I mean, obviously it was really, really eating him, but he just channeled all that to his playing, it seemed like, because it was unbelievable. And I've been a Stuart Copeland fan for many, 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 many years, one of my biggest influences. So it's been, you know, it was spectacular.
God, what a great opportunity to be able to do that. And to be able to do that again at a certain, you know, you spend a couple of years apart when then you come back together and everybody's growth, too. The other thing that I know has been taking up your time is traveling and actually took up some of your time at Bonnaroo was the movie Electric Apricot. You had a chance to show it there. How did it go over in what was initially, it's a film kind of lampoons jam band culture. Now, Bonnaroo was initially like the center of that. It's changed a bit over the years.
I didn't actually go to the screening because I was, to be honest with you, I was in the in my trailer trying to relearn Oysterhead songs. But I saw the pictures of the lines of people that were waiting to get into this thing that could not because it was packed out. It went really well. We've been in a few film festivals, and we've won a few awards. We're 3 for 3 at this point with the film festivals, which is great.
We've got
best feature in Malibu and best comedy in Tiburon and most inebriated audience at the Portland Lamba.
Explain the story of the quest for Festeroo.
Well, it's about these four musicians that are leaning towards middle age that have been poking around the jam scene in Northern California for a good number of years, and they're on the verge of a couple of substantial breaks, and this young filmmaker, UCLA grad student, makes a documentary about these four guys, and it takes place within the jam scene, and they get a chance to make a record, and they get the big break of being able to be on the third stage, second day of Festeroo, which is the holy grail of jam festivals.
Yes, not unlike another one. Obviously, you're seeking distribution. Are you getting closer to getting it out in theaters?
We've got some pretty hot irons in the fire right now, which we're very excited about. I don't want to...
Yeah,
I get
jinx them.
Yeah, I get scared by talking too much about that stuff. But it's been received incredibly well, more so than we thought. It was a huge pain in the ass to make, mainly because I think we had a gremlin. You know, it was like Murphy's Law times 100. Every day we would almost expect that kick in the nuts that just came along with this production. And I've said, I think it might even be in my bio, that that making this film it's very much like building a house, and building a house is an incredibly stressful thing. I used to be a carpenter, and you know, it's the cause of some ungodly amount of divorces in this country, and this was like building a house with a bunch of apprentice carpenters and the building material was on fire. It was just, but we ended up building this cool little house. It's not a mansion, but it came out well, and it's endearing.
It must make making an album, writing music, playing with other people, just a small group of people, just seems so easy.
I mean, it's cake.
Yeah, compared to that. Well, let's get back to some more music. I hate having these people stand around. What do you want to do next?
We'll do a song called One Better.
Anything we need to know about this?
It's sort of, you know, the American dream to get one better, to keep up with the Joneses, to outdo your neighbor, your friends, and you know, a couple references in the song go from getting a better car to you know, the United States in the space race with the Russians. So
this is One Better.
We'll be right back.
Les Claypool and this great band playing live for us today. These are tunes from the latest album of Wales and Woe, and that is One Better. This is going to seem like kind of a naive question, and I don't mean it that way, but why did Primus get so big? This was a really inventive, kind of incredible band that ended up at least touching on the mainstream. Do you scratch your head about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were the guys that were not supposed to be on MTV or be on the radio. Or I remember years ago talking to our attorney at the time, and we had gotten this offer for this publishing deal. And he's like, you know, I think you really should take this deal, blah, blah, blah. It's really a great thing. And, you know, the only way you could lose out on this deal is if you guys sell more than 100,000 records. And you don't really ever expect to do that, do you? And we're like, oh, well, I guess not, you know. We never expected any of this. And I would attribute, you know, the Primus thing, it never really exploded up. It was always a step-by-step thing. My whole career has been very, you know, much under the radar, baby steps. But we did get this little splash of MTV and radio. And it's really because of Tom Wally, you know, who is now president of Warner's, but at the time was an A&R guy for Interscope, which was this fledgling little company, and they had just signed a fellow by the name of Gerardo. So Tom's notion was, wait a minute, we're starting this label with this guy Gerardo. We need to sign something that will sort of counterbalance the, sugary implications of such a pop-oriented thing. And he found us. And at the time, we were being wooed by a bunch of labels because we sold like 80,000 copies of our own independent record. So all of a sudden people that didn't care were starting to care, but they all wanted, you know, me to wear my hair like the guys in Cinderella or, you know, get a singer or work with this producer, that producer. And Tom was the only guy that came along and said, you know, he had no idea we had sold all these records. He just saw us at a show. And he said, I really like this band. I want to sign you guys. And we had a great relationship. And he was just able to do these things for us that put us in the position to, you know, have Jerry Was a Race Car Driver on MTV and My Name is Mud. And he was a very intelligent guy, and he's got a lot of vision. So that and just working our asses off.
Yeah, I don't mean that it wasn't deserved from everything you did. Yeah, absolutely. Well, now, there are fans of Frog Brigade and who knows, maybe fans of what you're doing now, who always go, well, it's not Primus. And does that frustrate you in any way? Or because Primus always comes back around at some point.
It doesn't really frustrate me because I honestly believe that this hiatus that we went on was an incredibly healthy thing for all of us. And I speak strongly for myself because as a player, as a singer, as a writer, I've just grown incredibly. Because it's that same old thing, you're eating sushi every day, you know. But I also think that had we kept on going, for one thing, we're the band that would make a record, tour. We put out all these records in a very short period of time. And I look at my friends' bands, like the guys in Tool, that put out a record once every 4 or 5 years, and you know, it's it keeps them, you know,
they're sane.
It's a little more sane than us. Yeah. So I look at these things that I do, and it keeps me from bringing this sort of stuff that isn't really appropriate for Primus into Primus. So it keeps Primus pure to an extent because it's Larry and Tim and I as Primus. It's not me trying to bring in songs like Of Wales and Woe and One Better and these tunes that just that's just not appropriate for right. Primus. So in that respect, I think it's good for the Primus fans because I don't know how many bands you know of, but me growing up, there are many bands that I knew of that I was big fans of that would get tired of what they were doing and start bringing in horn sections and doing all these things that would convolute the original thing that made them popular. And I think by me doing all these projects or just doing my own thing, it helps keep this from getting convoluted. Same with Oysterhead, you know? It's about the three people as opposed to one guy bringing in a bunch of crap.
Speaking of one guy bringing in a bunch of – no, I want to talk a little bit about your bass sound. I was sitting here watching you during soundcheck, and what's the hardest thing to get come across on your bass sound as you're setting it up? What do you look for to make it sound right for you?
Since I was a kid, you know, I've wanted to get a cross between Chris Squire's sound, Larry Graham's sound, and Tony Levin's sound. You know, and those are three monstrous, very distinctive, very different sounds.
Yeah.
So I'm basically shooting for the moon here.
Yeah.
You know, but the bottom line is, and I this really was reinforced to me when I started playing with Stuart, is it's really how you attack your instrument. No matter how many things you're plugged into, what types of strings you use, or even the instrument itself, those are small variables. The biggest element is how you attack your instrument. I played with Stuart one time up in this barn with Trey up in Vermont, and the only kit that was there was this old 70s kit with these crappy old dead heads on it, big oversized toms that Fishman had left laying around. And so Stuart set them up in some junky old cymbals. It was like the polar opposite of anything you'd think Stuart Copeland would play on. And I thought, oh, my God, this isn't, you know. I'd been trying to get the Stuart Copeland snare drum and hi-hat sound for years with Tim Alexander and whoever. And he sits down and starts playing, and I listened to the tapes of it, and it sounded exactly like Stuart Copeland's snare, even though it was this big, tubby, dead thing, exactly like Stuart Copeland's hi-hats. It's all about how you approach your instrument. I see it with guitar players and, you know, Skerrick's sax playing. I am a firm believer that, and I think it's true with all forms of art, but with musicians especially, I see it's very reflective of your personality. You know, what comes out is a direct extension of one's personality. And if you've got someone who's extroverted, it's going to be an extroverted,
maybe a little hyperactive,
off to the left, off to the wherever, whatever it is. You know, lopsided. Yeah. You know, if you've got someone who's pretty mellow and conservative, they tend to play it safe. You know,
I'm laughing because I think I asked a similar question to Carlos Santana, and he sort of held up out of his hands.
Oh, well, so, he's total hand guy.
Yeah, that's, you know, where it comes from. So it's interesting. Well, yeah, you mentioned the title track of this. Can we hear Of Wales and Woe?
That's exactly what we're going to be playing. So.
Cool. This is Les Claypool and this great band playing live today. Be discreet. of Wales and Woe, finishing up our session today with Les Claypool and this great band. It's on the new album. Thank you so much for playing. Thanks mostly for the music over the years, and I can't wait to see the movie when he makes it into the...
Well, thanks for letting me come in here and make some racket.
Les Claypool, our guest, and we'll be back in a moment here on the World Cafe. Once again, big thank you to Les Claypool and company for playing live for us today. Les's solo album is called Of Wales and Woe, and it is at our World Cafe CD store. That's easy to find at our website at worldcafe.npr.org.